From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
This morning we welcome journalist Nathalia Holt. She has written a book about five women in the World War II, post-World War II era, who were spies. It's a true story, never been told before. Her book is called Wise Gals, The Spies Who Built the CIA and Changed the Future of Espionage.
Then we welcome local resident Renee Huang, the founder of Wild Women Tribe, a community group that connects like-minded women in transformational experiences outdoors.
And finally, New York-based energy healer and meditation teacher Laura Chung, who left corporate America to take on a new life. She discusses her book, How to Manifest, Make Your Dreams a Reality in 40 Days.
Our guest is best-selling author Nathalia Holt. During World War II and the tense post-period of the 50s and 60s, five women employed by the U.S. government moved around the globe like shadows. No one except their immediate superiors knew the exact nature of their work. Even their families had no clue. But though they appeared to live ordinary lives as secretaries and clerks, their jobs were far more complex and exponentially more dangerous than anyone could imagine. Nathalia joins us this morning to preview her new book on the topic, Wise Gals, The Spies Who Built the CIA and Changed the Future of Espionage. Nathalia, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So how did you discover these women? And when you found out about this information and this incredible story, how long did it take you to compile all this and dive into the story?
So it took me about 5 years to really dig in and write this story. And I came across it in a really unusual way. It started in 2017 when I was interviewing a woman on a completely unrelated subject. And she had this very surprising story to share with me. And it involved a Nazi war criminal and this shadowy American woman whom I found nearly impossible to track down. And as I searched for her, as I tried to search for the people in the story that I'd heard, I just uncovered this network of American women who built the CIA after their service in World War II. And this was just so surprising to me. I was really shocked by this because while there have been so much written about women in World War II, and of course, many books written about men in intelligence, very little has been written about female intelligence officers, particularly during the Cold War. So, you know, as I was combing through all these CIA biographies and histories, I realized that even the names of these women had been omitted from history. And it wasn't just one, it was this group of women, and they were called the Wise Gals. And, you know, this was a name given to them by their male colleagues because of their sarcastic, biting humor. And they were stationed all over the globe.
So what does it entail when you get your hands on CIA documents and finding individuals that essentially didn't exist on paper for a long time? What is that like to compile this information, and how's the process work with the government and uncovering and sharing classified documents, if you will?
So it starts with filing a Freedom of Information Act, which is what I did, and then working with the CIA to get all of the declassified documents possible for a book like this, which, as you can imagine, are many, many thousands. And then also going and digging into other archives. So I went through archives in England and in France and many here in the United States. And including, you know, smaller university archives that ended up having just all kinds of wealth of treasures. But there's so many details that you can only get when you talk to a person's family and friends. And, you know, sadly, the women that I write about in this book are no longer living. If they were living, I could never have written this book because their covers would probably still be classified and all of the operations they were part of would still be classified. But I was able to find their friends and family, and I also spoke with a large number of retired intelligence officers and some current intelligence officers that had worked with them. And so that was really how I was able to get so many personal details about what their lives were like, how it felt to be part of these operations. And then I was really fortunate through these family connections to be able to get some really personal moments clarified, you know, through diaries and photographs and letters, you know, things like that, that really make their stories what they are, really, really just sometimes heartbreaking and sometimes exciting, dangerous, but definitely inspiring.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Nathalia Holt. Her new book is called Wise Gals, The Spies Who Built the CIA and Changed the Future of Espionage. And Nat, this is not the first book that you've written about women in powerful positions. I think it's so great. It reminds me of that book that then became a best-selling film, Hidden Figures. It makes me wonder, in the research that you did, in a time that women really weren't valued in the workforce for, you know, more than being secretaries, how did it come to pass that these women were brought in to become spies?
So, you know, that's such a great question. And I love writing about women in history. And it's interesting to me, now that I've written several books about women in different industries, is to see how that happens, you know, how these women really kind of break free of stereotypes and manage to get these advanced positions. And in this case, it's really due in large part to a man named Bill Donovan, who is considered the father of American intelligence. He's the one that built the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, during World War II. And he saw a need for a diverse workforce in espionage. He understood that bringing in people of different backgrounds would really strengthen the spying the United States did during World War II. And so he brought in a ton of women, and as well as many other minorities, who was really interested in making this a powerful and strong workforce. And so it's really thanks to him then that you have these women who served in key roles as intelligence officers during World War II. And some of them were secretaries during that time as well. But then, because of his openness, he was able to advance them into these other positions. And of course, that doesn't mean that it was easy for them. And I document quite a few of their struggles in this book about moments when they really have to take on the agency and fight for their standing and for their positions, and of course, for pay increases, and even for the very nature of their work.
Well, let's talk about some of the women that you profile, starting with Eloise Page. She was, what you say, an unexpected mix of conservative lady and technological wizard, which seems so funny because we, you know, at that time, post-World War II, we aren't really in a technological age, but maybe that this was something that Eloise was really interested in and good at.
Yes, that is definitely true. So, you know, we don't think of it, of course, as our modern computing age, although these women did play a big role in bringing modern computers to the CIA. But Eloise becomes the chief of scientific and technical operations. And she does that with a number of women in her department, and they're working on spy gear. So I talk about all these different devices that they make in the book that are very important during the Cold War, when there is this great need to be able to transmit documents securely. And of course, you know, there's no cell phones in everyone's pocket. So they make these little tiny micro dot cameras that are able to scan documents. And they make dead drop devices, which are basically just things that look like rocks or stakes, and they're able to put documents in them and then hide them into certain places so that they can be picked up by one person and left by another. And then one of the most interesting spy gear that I talk about in the book is this coded woman's compact. So basically just looks like any kind of old-fashioned woman's compact with, you know, which is basically just a circle that opens and has the mirror inside. But this one, when you hold it at a certain angle, it reveals a secret message. And so this was actually designed by another woman, Adelaide Hawkins, but under Eloise Page, when she's head of scientific and technical operations. And this was just another way for the many women they had that were spying for the U.S. and that were working in espionage to be able to communicate. And so it's really interesting to see how during this period, when they're spying on the Soviets in this book, they're able to use all of these devices to be able to get information back to the United States. And this really ends up preventing war. What they find out and uncover during these operations has a profound effect in Washington and their ability to then not aggravate and make certain situations worse. And I go into a lot of detail about that in the book.
So to kind of follow up on Lynn's question about the background of them, are they already involved in the military and are they cherry-picked from other departments, or do they have backgrounds in high academics and things like that? And are there common traits between all of them that made them a good team?
You know what I love is that they're all so different. So, you know, there's some women like Adelaide Hawkins, who is a single mom of three. She has a high school education. She's from a small town in the South, and she is well aware that nobody expects anything from her. And yet she becomes this very powerful woman in the CIA. She becomes the chief of covert communications, and she has an important role to play in many different operations. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have Mary Hutchinson, who's an officer who has a PhD in archaeology. She's fluent in four languages. She serves in the military. And even with all of this, she at first is only offered a secretary job when she applies for the CIA. And she turns on the man who's interviewing her and says, quote, "That's a complete waste of my abilities." And, you know, that's how I just think it really underlines the point that it doesn't really matter necessarily what your background is. It really matters what they brought to these positions. So you can be someone like Adelaide Hawkins, who, you know, only had a high school diploma and yet managed to scrape by and work her way up. Or someone like Mary Hutchinson, who, even though she had this PhD and was so well educated, still had to really fight to get her position in the CIA.
It's just truly incredible. Like Lynn said, I mean, I'm a sucker for these Hollywood type movies, and this is right up that alley with that. So when you say they changed the future of espionage for this country and everything, what was it that they did that impacted the effect the Wise Gals had on the intelligence world?
So in the 1950s, there is this really big event that happens, and it starts on, you know, kind of this foggy morning, February 1953, when Alan Dulles is sworn in as director of the CIA. And at first, nothing really startling happens. You know, Alan Dulles is merely standing in front of a crowd at the CIA during the ceremony. And he himself was not new to the CIA. He had served as deputy director, and so everybody expected him to be appointed. But what happened next was very surprising. And that's because as the ceremony comes to a close, Dulles asked, "Do you have any questions?" And immediately this group of women, the Wise Gals, just began peppering him with questions. And they asked, "Why are women hired at a lower grade than men? Do you think that women are given sufficient recognition in the CIA? As the new director of the CIA, are you going to do anything about the professional discrimination against women?" You can imagine, you know, even for a modern workplace, to have these kind of questions asked of a new agency director on the day of his swearing in would be, let's just say, bold. But in 1953, this was really unheard of. Nothing like this had happened before. And what happened from this moment is that the women formed what was mockingly called the Petticoat Panel. And this was a panel intent on gaining equity for female officers at the agency. And it is important to note here that women comprised a very large number of women of officers at the CIA at this time, about 39%, which was higher than the American workforce at total, which was about 30%. So already they were starting with a leg up, but despite that, they still weren't be given the promotions and pay raises they'd earned. So they started this panel, and it was just as much, though, about gaining more equity at the agency as it was about fighting for their type of work at the CIA, and that is espionage. And so what we see happening at that time is that when Dulles comes in as director, he immediately wants to downgrade espionage and rise up paramilitary and covert action at the CIA. And he says this very expressly to the people at the agency. And he also says, quote, "We have to face the fact that because espionage is relatively cheap, it will always seem inconsequential. What kind of impression can it make when I come along and ask for a few $100,000 and a bag of pennies?" And this was really how we saw these spying operations. They just didn't bring enough money to the CIA, and they didn't raise the profile of the CIA. So the Pedico panel is really a very complex time for the agency, because the women are fighting for themselves and for their advancement. They're fighting for the future of women at the CIA, but they're also fighting for really the soul of what the agency is about: espionage, what had always been the cornerstone of American intelligence, and trying to make sure that even though these operations didn't cost a lot of money, that they would be preserved. And what we see is that Dulles ends up pursuing these very controversial moments that really tarnished the agency's reputation in the years ahead. And this includes overthrow of governments in Iran and Guatemala, Project MK Ultra, the Bay of Pigs. And all of this ends up leading to Dulles's dismissal in 1961 by President Kennedy over his handling of Cuba. So it's really the women that end up getting the last laugh. And because they kept pursuing espionage and kept fighting for the role of their kind of work, they ended up being able to continue that. And what we're seeing is that even today, there is a resurgence in this kind of espionage, and the kind of work that the CIA is doing in Ukraine is very much based on the work that these women did building the first American spy network in Ukraine after World War II. So there's a lot of operations that I can talk about too that had these very profound effects on American history. But I think that you can see how keeping espionage as part of American intelligence really changed the future of the agency.
You know, it's interesting because of the very nature of the secrecy surrounding espionage. We as lay people, our experience of espionage is largely through James Bond or you know, whatever pop culture film we're seeing or spy novel that we're reading. We have this sense that espionage is very physical, you know, everything that James Bond performs during his day-to-day operation, you know, would be difficult for, especially at this time, for a woman that isn't a big brute, basically. So I'm wondering about the physicality of that, especially now, as you know, women are very strong and very able and capable, but maybe at that time it wasn't so prevalent.
You know, I think a lot of this comes down to the misrepresentation of what spies do that happens in Hollywood. Obviously, James Bond is not a real spy, and you can't really jump out of cars and airplanes and all of these things. And as much as I love those movies and as fun as they are, they do not represent the real world of what life is like for an officer in the CIA. There's so many different roles, of course. There's many different kinds of officers that play a role in all different kinds of operations. But I'll tell you a little bit about Elizabeth Sudmeyer to give you an idea of what it was like to be an officer in the CIA in the 1950s. Now, she served in World War II and then did junior officer training at the CIA before being stationed in Syria and then Iraq. And she spent most of her career in Baghdad. Now, when she was there, she did what is considered kind of the holy grail for CIA agents, and that is called a full cycle, where you recruit, develop, and handle your own agents. And she was able to do this in a way that really no other man could have done in the region, because the way that she recruited her agents was through a tailor shop and through a hair salon. And so she went into these places pretending to be just a regular housewife, or sometimes she pretended to be a teenager, sometimes she pretended to be a simple secretary of the government, and ended up making friends and then bringing these friends into her fold and learning more about them, learning about their husbands, learning about the kind of work they did. And through this, she then made these contacts and was able to form this huge network of spies. And she met these spies in movie theaters and in cafes where they would secretly pass information to one another. And some of the information she was getting were technical plans about Soviet fighter jets. And this was really important at the time because the United States was trying to create its own spy plane, which would then fly over the Soviet Union. And they had to know what they were up against. They didn't know how to build this plane if they didn't know who their adversary would be. And so Elizabeth Sedmeyer was able to steal all kinds of technical information on Soviet weaponry that made a huge difference in the course of the Cold War. And she did it through these small operations. She was also incredibly brave. So in 1958, Iraq experienced a coup. There was a revolution. The royal family was killed. And immediately, every American in the country was a target, and many were being killed as well. So every CIA officer in Baghdad left on that day in 1958, except for Elizabeth Sedmeyer. She stayed. She was the only one. And she did this because she wanted to protect their spies in the region. She wanted to protect the networks that she had built. And so at great personal risk, she managed to stay in the country, handle their spies, and keep transmitting information back to Washington. And that information was very important because in Washington, you can imagine that once this revolution happened in Iraq, there was a real fear, and there were, and many of the advisors to President Eisenhower were telling him, send in troops, we need to get into Iraq. And it was largely thanks to a lot of the information being sent by Liz that that did not happen and that war did not escalate further in the region. And it was because of this, actually, that Liz received the Intelligence Medal of Merit. And it wasn't, this is a very high-standing medal to get at the CIA. But as you can imagine, male administrators in Washington were very hesitant to give it to her. They said that a woman couldn't possibly have earned it. And it was really thanks to Liz's station chief, a man named Arthur Callahan, that she was able to receive this medal at all and really mark this incredible sacrifice she made during that operation in Iraq.
That's fascinating. Wise gals, the spies who built the CIA and changed the future of espionage is out. Nathalia, thank you for joining us on The Mountain Life. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with David Windsor. We welcome to the show Laura Chung. Laura is a New York-based energy healer and meditation teacher. She has her master's in industrial and organizational psychology and spent most of her adult life in corporate America. But, well, like many, became dissatisfied with a traditionally successful life, quote unquote, and quit her job in 2017. She became nomadic and traveled around the world, eventually becoming a Reiki master, podcaster, and something she calls a manifestation expert. She joins us now to discuss her new book, How to Manifest, Make Your Dreams a Reality in 40 Days. Laura Chung, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. What was it specifically that made you sort of dissatisfied with this otherwise successful life in terms of your career?
Yeah, I think as a daughter of immigrant parents, I was definitely raised with this idea of safety and security and financial wellness ever since I was little. And when I started working in private equity in New York City, and I was making a decent amount of money and I had a very stable life, and everybody around me in my orb were millionaires and making tons of money. And what I witnessed from that experience was that not everybody was happy. And it didn't seem like the kind of wealth and abundance and prosperity that I had in mind for myself was present in that environment. Everybody just had this depression, sadness, like they were constantly working to not live. And I realized that there was more to it than just the making of the money. There was something missing. And so that's where I started getting curious and asking questions for myself.
Right. It is sort of a first world problem, though, you might
totally
say. And,
totally.
And you were allowed this luxury of switching course because you were in a field where you were making a lot of money. And I'm just wondering, because you coach people on manifesting, you know, their dreams and their realities, how do you explain that part? Because it would be very difficult to leave from a factory worker job where you're making, you know, minimum wage and say, well, this isn't really my dream after all.
I'm so glad you asked that question, because that's where I felt the manifestation discussion was lacking. Because when I started really studying this topic, I mean, I'm sure everybody has heard about The Secret, thoughts become things, and just think positive thoughts. Well, if that was true, then more people would be wealthy, more people would quit their jobs. And then I also asked the question, what is that? Then why aren't people manifesting, and why aren't people leaving their jobs? And there's a very clear answer to that. It's that we still have systemic issues. And I just want to be real about that. Like, we do face poverty. There are things that hold people back. And so we manifest at the individual and collective level. So collectively, for whatever reason, we're going through this paradigm, this reality right now where people are still poor, people don't have access to water. But I would say, yes, I'm privileged in that way that I was able to have a high paying job that I could save money. But I also come from a collectivist culture where abundance and manifestation is shared with your community. So hopefully, like, when more people are able to manifest and have financial wellness, they can give back to their communities. That saying, a rising tide lifts all boats. And that's just the way that I operate my life. Just to put this in there too, like, America, the United States is one example of like a hyper individualized culture where everybody is like an entrepreneur and, you know, like me, mine, and I'm gonna just keep my wealth. And it's not that way everywhere else in the world.
Where did your parents immigrate from?
South Korea.
Laura, I was curious, when it comes to manifestation, like, you know, these are things I've grown up with my mom and all these other individuals in my life. And I completely agree with the idea of you have to see it to believe it. You have to have a roadmap to set the goals. You have to know where you want to go in order to achieve it. But my question is, in your line of work with manifestation, how are you helping the individuals to actually execute on the plan? Because you can think all these great thoughts all you want, but at the end of the day, you have to put in the work and you have to show up and do the plan necessary for the manifestation to come to reality.
Right. And where I think this is where my spiritual, if you don't like the word spiritual, we could say consciousness. This is where that comes in. Because when people think about, this is what I want, they always think outwardly, like, I have to go get it. I have to go do this. Whereas what I'm proposing in my book is, it's more of an inner work. It's more unblocking and unveiling and unfolding of the limiting beliefs and the conditioning and the stories that you told and were raised with to reveal your innate manifesting abilities. Because we were all born with it. We just forgot them because of the way we were raised, generational trauma, ancestral stories. A lot of people, again, we were conditioned as Americans to go get after something, to chase something. But as an energy healer, when you do that, it just moves that thing further away. So we're talking about attraction and magnetism, and that comes from something within you.
So you mentioned the story, changing the story. So yeah, we all have a story that we tell ourselves to make ourselves believe, good or bad, about what we can achieve. And how do you help individuals start to change that story and look within of the limiting beliefs they tell themselves?
Yeah, so I'm going to go back to what you said. You said it's a lot of people need to see it before they believe it. But for me, it's you believe it, then you see it. And for a lot of like BIPOC women as myself, like it's hard for us to believe, like this is like, I can't even believe I'm doing this because nobody in my family has written a book. Nobody in my family has been on a radio show. Like I'm the first of my entire, both sides of my family. And how did I believe that that was possible? Well, I had to do a lot of like deprogramming and belief in myself and like speak and share my story. And that's not easy because we're wired for connection. We're wired for having acceptance from our parents. And for a really long time, I was always seen as like the weird one with no direction. And why is she traveling? Why did she quit her job? But there's this like innate belief in myself that I'm made to help other people who look like me to get after their dreams. So I would say it really begins with just asking yourself, start with your, there's a day here about ancestral stories. Like if your ancestors were refugees and were never wealthy, do you believe that it's possible for you? Like that's where you can start.
Yeah, your story of your parents as immigrants, as you say, you upset the cart, right? By breaking out, but it was their manifestation of their dream to come to America where they thought mm-hmm. that they would have better opportunity. And now you're sort of forwarding that American dream by leaving corporate America. Mm-hmm. That is a very interesting paradox in and of itself.
Yes.
And to the extent that you decided to write a book, it's a 40-day plan, How to Manifest. Can you kind of dissect or deconstruct what the book is all about in terms of a really clear-cut plan?
Sure. So it's a 40-day journey, and the 40 days comes from when I went to India to study yoga. They say that it takes 40 days to break a habit and create new ones. And so some people think it's 28, some people say it's 30, but there's all sorts of spiritual texts that refer to 40 days. And I felt like it was enough time where people really get, you know, used to this idea of getting into a habit, because the only way to create change is to disrupt a pattern and to constantly do something and persistently with repetition. So every day there's a short thing that you read, and it's based on my own experience and also my mentors and people that I mentor and my clients. So real manifestation stories. And then at the end of the reading, there is a practice for you to do, because again, like we can intellectualize this all we want and talk about it, but real change happens through doing and taking action. So it's not the kind of like plan, or it's not like doing the work in a way where it's outward. It's more inward. It's like looking at yourself, being really curious, asking tons of questions. Like, why do you believe in certain things? Like, even so simple as like, I ask people, what does wealth mean to you? Right? Like that word is tossed around so much, but the etymology mm-hmm. of wealth is health. So it's not just money. It's like the health of our relationships, the health of our body, the health of our mind and our emotion and our spiritual connection. So it is a whole system. It's not just money. And then how will you know when you're wealthy if you don't define that for yourself?
Laura, you mentioned a moment ago about The Secret, and I think this was a big why people criticize The Secret. As David said, it's like, oh yeah, just think about it and it will happen to you. Just go ahead and sit on the couch. Well, not that it said that, but this is what I like about your book, is that it's very concrete, very specific steps to how you do it and how you uncover what you want to manifest. That's mm-hmm. step one. Most of us don't even know what we want to manifest.
Exactly. Exactly. Most of us don't even know who we are because we've never taken the time to really like look at ourselves.
Is there a series of steps that you have individuals do to break down the looking at themselves and understanding call it their why mm-hmm. they want the wealth or the happiness mm-hmm. or the child, or is there certain things that we do to look internally for that?
Yes, it's basically the 40-day journey. The first day is like, what have you manifested in your life? Because another thing to understand is we're manifesting all the time. We're creating our reality through our thoughts and our beliefs and our actions and our decisions every single day. But what people want is something different. They want something that they desire. So in order for you to get to that desired state, you have to fundamentally change. And then like when you get to about like week three, it's like, all right, let's get really deep. Like, what was your childhood like? What were your parents like? Did your parents speak about money in a very scarcity mentality way? Where are your grandparents from? Were your grandparents in a war? You know, all of those things matter in how you see your life.
I never thought of it like that, that you're manifesting every day and essentially, yeah, I manifest what I'm going to cook for dinner. And so yeah. You are taking those steps to do it and to break down what you want. And as an individual it's different for everybody else. And so mm-hmm. when someone gets to the end of their journey, which you can't ever really get to the end of it, but if I'm trying to manifest a specific thing and I get there, how do we help individuals cope with the feeling of I've reached this goal? And is it just a continuation of what's the next manifestation?
Thank you for asking that, because it's never about the thing. When people say they want to manifest money or they want to manifest their soulmate, I always ask them, what feeling are you trying to get? Money really represents to people like safety and security or freedom. Manifesting a soulmate for people, it's like safety and security or, you know, love. And I'm always like, once you manifest a thing, that need, that want is always going to be there. So you might as well look deeper inside yourself and fill that void in you so that you just become like a magnet. Life is like this. There's ebbs and flows, and you want to be full and whole even in the ebb, even when like you have a dry spell in your life, like you still want to feel abundant and loved. So it's really about the wholeness within yourself versus the actual thing. But of course, like we're human, so we want to have the nice things.
Laura Chong is our guest, and her book is How to Manifest, Make Your Dreams a Reality in 40 Days. Laura, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. Great.
Thank
stuff.
You so much.
Through day-long wander, workshops, and multi-day retreats, Wild Women Tribe endeavors to get dynamic women of all ages and stages out of their comfort zone and rewilding back into their true selves. Joining us in the studio to preview an upcoming day-long event on October 1st called Playing with Fire is founder of Wild Women Tribe, Renee Huang. Welcome to The Mountain Life, Renee.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. How long ago did you start this organization, and what prompted you to do so?
I think it's been actually 4 or 5 years now, which is mind-blowing to me because, you know, time flies when you're having fun. I started it because I was at a point in my life where I was really searching for more depth and meaning in my relationships, and I really wanted to take advantage of the amazing outdoors that we have in our backyard here. I'd already gone on a bunch of girls' kind of weekends and camping trips, and I thought, you know what? I'm just going to jump in there and like see if other women who are in that position, who want to have that depth and that interaction, want to do this with me. And so I started partnering with coaches and facilitators, and all of our experiences really center around getting into the outdoors and grounding into nature and having these really kind of below the surface interactions together.
So I would imagine that you see a bunch of women from all different dynamics of life. People have lost loved ones, going through a divorce, just feeling stuck in life. Is there a common theme that a lot of these women come to this program with, or is it all different elements that you're trying to help everyone tap into different types of feelings?
Yeah, it's the type of woman who loves being outdoors first and foremost. We do our programs throughout the four seasons. And so in the winter, we end up doing snowshoe hikes. And in the summer, it's, you know, hikes on the beautiful trails here. But all the women have this common ground of being curious, being seekers, asking questions, you know, wanting to go below the surface and find out what makes people tick. And so it's people who want to step into self-growth and self-inquiry and have those experiences that are beyond just the cursory day-to-day, hey, how are you? You know, what's new in your life?
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Renee Huang. She's the founder of the Wild Women Tribe, and she's joining us to talk about Playing with Fire, it's called, coming up on October 1st. It's one of the retreats. This one is about a five-hour-long retreat, so sort of all day, you can think of it. And you're teaming up with Danielle Bryan, who is a shaman. Tell us what Danielle is going to bring to the day.
Yeah, so we do day-long workshops that are called wanders because we just wander around, and it's, you know, a metaphor for kind of diving into things and following the leads down trails that we're not sure of. And Danielle and I are partnering on this day that really evokes a lot of the Peruvian shamanic traditions that she has learned and that she teaches through her Medicine Wheel program at Shamanic Twist, which is her center that she has in Camas. And so all of the wanders have a different theme. And so I think that helps focus women. Like David, you were asking, you know, what's the common thread? And so women coming to this will know that we're going to go into intentions. We're going to go into a lot of self-inquiry and looking at things that we can release and also call into the next season of our life. It's going to involve a lot of ceremonial aspects of this Peruvian Aini Despacho ceremony, which involves gathering elements of nature, putting intentions in them, and then actually setting it on fire. So we call it Playing with Fire because we will be setting things on fire, diving into like what a burn release is. And then we're also going to be making these sage bundle smudge kits, these like beautiful ornamental sage bundle things that are used are involving elements gathered from just the nature around us.
Great. So it also includes lunch and a yoga flow and hike. And I would assume, depending on, you know, if you're teaming up with someone with their various strengths and what they bring to a workshop, and also where you are in the world, because I know you have workshops that go from Mexico to Sedona, you know, around here and where else? And I guess it depends on where you are and who you're with, what creates this day, this wander.
Well, what I love about this type of work is it's really women's work. It's supporting and collaborating and co-creating with women who are also in this realm of stepping into themselves. And a lot of these small business owners, I love supporting them. And so it's this like other concentric circle of creating programs for women, but also with women. And so yes, each of the coaches and facilitators brings their own flavor to the table. And the idea is, you know, we introduce something new, a concept that might be unknown to the women who are attending. And then if they want to dive deeper, they can go and follow and support and give business to that woman who has introduced them to a new concept.
So October 6th through the 9th, you have a program in Arizona and Unbecoming and Unlearning Common Habits. I'm a big believer in and advocate of someone that we are defined by our habits. What we do on a daily basis, an hourly basis, is basically who we are as a person. And so how do you allow and encourage individuals to unbreak these habits, or if you will?
Yeah, so we're going to Sedona, which is like a magical place. It's, you know, very similar to Southern Utah, but there's a lot of what people call vortexes of energy there. And so it's a great place to do intentional self-growth transformation work. And initially we called the retreat Becoming Limitless. So it's this idea of like becoming kind of the co-creator of your own life in an active way. And then the more we kind of looked at it, we realized it's more of an unbecoming, like unlearning of these habits and masks and armor that we put on to kind of show up in the world the way that we think we need to. And so I think it starts with intention, starts with awareness, and it starts with intention to really open yourself up to a different way of being. And I think what we're gonna be doing is learning a lot of tools and practices, because it's a practice. You never really fully arrive, right? Like when you are growing and in a stage of evolution, you get to the next level, and then there's always another place that you can evolve to. So we're really learning practices that we can take away from retreat. It's not like a retreat is something you need to go to in order to progress. We want people to know that you learn tools, you take it back into life, you fold it in, and then you see where that goes.
Absolutely. It's all about taking that experience with you for the longer term. So you mentioned earlier before we started recording that this is, as you started this venture, it's exciting, it's scary, it pulls at a lot of different emotions as you've now become a business owner, and this is your career and your passion and the thing you're pursuing the most. And I'm curious what the thing that is the most rewarding for you as you do these adventures. I'm sure it's more about running a business and the logistics. It's about the experience that each individual gets out of it. And so what's become the most rewarding part about it?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I love it because it's like it brings me back to the reason why, right? And for me, I wanted to become more in touch with myself as a person and allow all of the different sides of myself to come out. And so for me, the most rewarding part is seeing women step into that realm as well, you know, asking the questions and being like, okay, so I'm self-defined by all of these external labels in my life. I'm a wife, I'm a mother, I'm a sister, I'm a daughter, but who am I truly? And so for me, I think the most beautiful part of this work is allowing other women to start that process, start that journey, and start asking those questions of digging deeper, you know, and reconnecting to themselves in a way that is maybe not as encouraged in our fast-paced day-to-day, everyday lives.
We're speaking about a wander for women, but as David is sitting here, very male, his wife has done one of your retreats. And so, you know, men, if you're listening now, this could be something that you treat your female partner to. So I wanted to mention that, you know, in our previous interview with Laura Chung, you know, she was talking about manifestation and commenting it kind of like you are now about the biggest challenge is to find out what it is that you want to do. And so often, I think with women, especially because we're required to fulfill all of these different roles as, you know, maybe wife, mother, and career person, and, you know, stay-at-home person, and all this, that our identity sort of gets lost. And so figuring out what it is, where we want to be with ourselves is such a big challenge. And you know, tell us a story about that.
Well, I think we are trained so well as women, not necessarily intentionally, but we take on a lot of that role of caregiving and space holding for people and for aspects of life. And so for me, I identified so much outwardly, like, what can I do to caretake, you know, my family, my kids, my work, my everything, right? And so I think coming to different cycles of life where I have felt unsatisfied or like there's more, you know, the realization that I came to that was so transformative for me was that I could change everything around myself, but if I didn't connect with myself and really serve myself, then everything else could be quote unquote perfect and I could still be discontent. So for me, it's like inviting women to come home to themselves in order to find more satisfaction, find more happiness, you know, find more of their reason for being. And then it affects, you know, their husbands and their kids and their friends and their work. So once you do the work on yourself, then the concentric circles of satisfaction with life and happiness and influence and inspiration just kind of naturally flow from you rather than from like an external source.
Well, that inspiration coming from you kind of oozing out of your pores is quite palpable as you're sitting in the room. So I think it's a good thing. It's wildwomentribe.net. You can go on. It's a great website. And so again, it's October 1st. That is for the 5-hour journey in around here. Where is that?
Right. We'll be in Camas. So we'll start at Shamanic Twist and we'll have an hour yoga flow and then move into a mindful hike where there's all sorts of juicy surprises for connection there. And then the rest of the day is outdoors. So hiking outdoors, despacho ceremony, sage bundle, and then burn ceremony.
Great.
As Lynn mentioned, I mean, your energy and your passion towards this is palpable. Seeing you be moved by this is a testament to what you are out there doing for these other women. And as Lynn mentioned as well, my wife went on this trip, and I can speak on behalf of our household that she was having a tough time with work and the stresses of the current real estate market and what was going on. And it was a great way for her to unplug and realize that she was not tied to the identity of being in her career and what makes or breaks the sale. And so as these women kind of separate from this weekend and this journey, is there tools and ways that they can stay involved with the Wild Women, and how can they continue on this journey?
Yeah, each retreat container has its own kind of support network that we start beforehand and continue after. So I want people to know as well, it's not just me who is creating these. There's a whole group of facilitators that are unique to each of the retreats. And so we'll have our facilitator team available on a WhatsApp group chat, and they often share resources and links through there. And we do a lot of follow-up and kind of checking in with the girlfriends afterwards.
Excellent. Well, Renee, thank you so much. The Wild Women Tribe, October 1st. Also, we have one in Sedona, Arizona, October 6th through the 9th. Thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life today.
Thank you guys so much.
Great to see you again.
Yeah, great to see you.
And thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.